Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. David Mendel is a big deal in robotics. He's a professor of aeronautics and astronautics at MIT, and for more than 30 years, he's used robots to explore the uncharted depths of the ocean floor. And he's researched how they've taken us to the moon, to war, and to the cutting edge of medicine. But David Mendel is not convinced that robots will ever do any of these things on their own.
In his new book, Our Robots Ourselves, Robotics and the Myths of Autonomy, Mendel argues robots will always need humans. And because of that, we humans need to change the way we think about robots.
David Mendel joins us now in the studio to talk about why. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Meghna. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. I would just love to start with a simple exploration of the subtitle of your book, Robotics and the Myths of Autonomy. What myths do we have, are we plagued by, regarding robotic autonomy?
So I think there's a number of sort of ways that people imagine robotics is going to progress in the world that I try to debunk a little bit in the story. One of them I call the myth of linear progress, and that is that we go from a human-occupied system like an airliner to a remotely operated system like sort of today's drones to a fully autonomous system, and somehow that's a natural progression of the technology. Then there's the myth of replacement, which is that those things replace human jobs one for one, when actually we know that they tend to change human jobs and move them around but not always replace them. And third is what I call the myth of full autonomy, which is the idea that somehow the ultimate expression of the technology is the robots operating completely on their own with no human involvement at all. And I try to go at all these myths in succession through stories about how people use robots in the world today, because
okay,
there are many places that people do.
So I want to hear some of the stories in just a moment, but when you look at these three myths in combination, you seem to be undermining just about everything that people think about robots. You know, I mean, the replacement myth, your colleagues at MIT, Andrew McAfee and Eric Brynjolfsson, have written a book about how, look out, white-collar workers, the robots are coming for your jobs. And full autonomy, I mean, I feel like a big chunk of science fiction, everything from Terminator to HAL, Skynet to The Matrix, just would not exist had we not actually had this genuine deep-seated human fear of a fully autonomous system.
Well, I think we may well have that fear, and then maybe that fear is well-placed. And certainly robotics and automation reduce the numbers of people in certain places, but they also really move them around. And what you see is changes in skills, changes in the number of people, but every robotic system, every software artificial intelligence system we have today is a human design system that embodies human assumptions and predictions of how the world ought to go. And we want to look closely at those things and make sure that we understand what the people are doing, where they are, and how they're influencing the systems we're using.
So the overarching sort of then thinking or direction of the systems we are still in control of. But what about the persistent skeptic, and maybe I'm one of them, who says, yes, this is all true for now?
Well, what the book does is goes through the last sort of 50 and 60 years, and quite a bit of it in the last 5 years, about how people use robotics and automated systems today. Because there are a lot of places, particularly in extreme environments, where they're just a matter of daily work and people use them all the time. And what you see time and time again is people designing a system. The Air Force's Predator, the famous drone that's been used in Iraq and Afghanistan, is a great example. Design a system to be fully unmanned, operate with no human input, and then gradually, as that system makes its way into the field and becomes expensive and responsible for human life and taking human life, the human interventions are added in at various points. And that's something I've just seen over and over and over again. And there is a counter argument that says, well, this time it's different. Computers are just better. But the weight of everything we know about how the world of robotics works says people are always going to be in there at some point, and we need to be prepared for it.
Well, so, I mean, this is why it's particularly powerful and fascinating that you, David Mendel, have written this book, because you worked with robots to do very cutting-edge exploration on those extreme environments that you were talking about. I mean, tell us from your own personal experience in using autonomous robots to explore the deepest ocean floors. What's that like?
Well, I started working with Bob Ballard's group in Woods Hole in the 1980s, right after they found the Titanic. And we were convinced, and, you know, again, some of these myths of autonomy that I lay out in the book are myths that I believed very deeply, certainly for throughout the 1990s and into the 2000s. We believed that robots were going to replace people in the ocean. We were no longer going to send people down to the seafloor, and the robots were going to be cheaper and safer. It turned out Woods Hole still operates their submersible Alvin, which they've been doing since 1964. They just spent many millions of dollars to upgrade it. The remote vehicles are with us as well as our new autonomous vehicles. And if anything, those three ways of experiencing the seafloor are converging rather than replacing each other. Almost everything we do has some element of human presence, some element of remote presence, some element of autonomous presence. And the autonomous robots really aren't autonomous for very long. In fact, they're autonomous for as little as we possibly can make them because they're expensive and they do important work and we want to stay in touch and know what they're up to.
Well, I mean, in fact, you did work with a robot that had a name, Abe, the autonomous benthic explorer, which, as you point out in your book, is the only robot to ever have had an obituary in the New York Times. I mean, we looked it up and the headline was Abe, pioneering robotic undersea explorer, is dead at 16.
Right. It was a very sad story in some ways. The people who were principally responsible for Abe, my friend Dana Yerger and Barry Walden and Al Bradley, brought that robot through a very long gestation and really did amazing things with it and operated it for the better part of 15 years before it was lost in the deep ocean. And at the same time, when it was lost, when it catastrophically imploded at a very great depth, no one was hurt, no one died, and they went on and built the next one. Actually, the next one was already coming online. And Abe was a vehicle that when we first imagined it, we thought it would be living in the ocean, doing the science kind of on its own for months or years at a time. And at the end of the day, when it actually proved what it was really good for, it was incredible at digitizing the seafloor, making precise maps that were not possible to make otherwise, and bringing those maps up to human explorers, scientists on the surface, who could then, using a computer in the comfort of their own labs or universities, explore the seafloor by exploring the data.
You know, actually, in looking at the Times obituary of Abe, that got me thinking because they write that Abe, this is from the New York Times again, a nomadic adventurer that plumbed the world's oceans on its own, forever changing the way scientists explored the seafloor, was lost at sea on March 5th off southern Chile. But just that description to me made me sort of circle back to an initial point that you make in the book about, you know, our relationships, the relationships that we have as human beings with these robots. Because I read a sentence like a nomadic adventurer and I think, isn't part of the issue that we as humans sort of want to assign some agency to these robots?
Yeah, that's a great question. And certainly, you know, engineers name robots, although I think for most engineers, the robots are a kind of recalcitrant pile of parts as much as they are human-like. And Abe, actually, interestingly, Abe, which looked a little bit like the Starship Enterprise from Star Trek, the designers actually put the letters NCC 1701, which is the call sign of the Starship Enterprise. So their model for it was as much a spaceship as it was a furry kind of friendly robot. But you do constantly see, and I talk about it in the book, this tension between the public accounts, the public mythologies of robots as embodied human-like agents and the sort of way that they're used in practical operations where they tend to be. They are very human-like, and they're human-like because they're our creations, and they carry our ideas, our messages, our models of the world with them. But so the creatures that the robots embody are us, hence the title of the book, Our Robots Ourselves.
So let's talk about when that goes wrong, because in the section of the book about aeronautics and air travel, you do write about the fall of Air France Flight 447. Can you remind us what happened there?
So Air France 447 was a very modern Airbus airliner flying from Brazil to France in 2009. And high above the ocean in some bad weather, but not horrifically bad weather, there was a problem with part of the airliner late at night. And what happened was the computers that operated the airliner in a fly-by-wire system just checked out, and they handed this airliner in a very challenging flight regime back to the pilots all of a sudden without a whole lot of explanation of what was going on. As it happened, the problem that caused that cleared itself in about a minute, but the pilots were confused. They had trouble understanding what was going on. And after a minute, it was a perfectly good airliner, but they lost control. They stalled it, and it fell barreling down into the ocean, and everyone aboard was lost. It was a very tragic story. And a story about how, again, for all the automation and computers that are built onto the aircraft, there are human directions built into it. Those human directions had problems. The pilots were probably not as familiar with hand-flying the aircraft as they might have been. It took them by surprise. This became known as the handoff problem, how you go from automatic to manual, and it has to be something very carefully engineered and not taking the person by surprise.
So this presents a challenge then, though, because if as you're saying, if I'm hearing you right, you're saying that we will forever be in a place where robotic systems will rely on humanity for something, whether it be the initial programming, the decision trees by which they decide what to do, even the value systems by which they make those decisions, if I can use that language. I mean, in a way, that sort of bursts the bubble for techno-utopians who say, but wait a minute, we actually want to remove human beings from the picture altogether. I am kind of one of those when it comes to self-driving cars. Like, I would love to see no Bostonian behind the wheel of a car.
Well, you know, I'm glad you raised value systems. Think about the ongoing scandal with Volkswagen and the environmental control systems. Not so much their story of autonomy, but certainly a story about software and corporate values being built into the software in your car that you may or may not agree with. And in this case, I think there's a lot of Volkswagen owners who are feeling burned by a disagreement in values. Extend that idea to larger questions about the actual control of your car when your life is at stake. I think there's a great deal of benefit to be gained from a lot of different kinds of autonomy and automatic features on your car, new sensors, new cameras, new algorithms. I want all that stuff in my car helping keeping me and my family safe. But I also want the ability to stay in control of my own fate, to set the values by which the machine is operating, and to have some say into the system.
Mm. Well, in the last minute or so that we have, I'm curious. prior to Skynet becoming self-aware and sentient, Lord, I mean, I am bringing science fiction back into the conversation here. But I mean, that is the nightmare scenario. Short of that, what do you think? I mean, you make a call in the book for human beings to reassess their relationships with robots and what we view as the robotic world. So what do you think is the ideal view that we should have of that relationship?
Well, I've come to call that relationship the perfect five, where engineers often talk about levels of automation, where level one is full manual control, level 10 is full autonomy. And I'm really trying to revise our notion of progress that we're not progressing toward, and we shouldn't be pushing so much toward full autonomy, which doesn't even really exist anyway, but rather the perfect five, which is not to say equal automation and manual control, but where the user has control exactly over what the system is doing, what sort of automated features to use, the way you turn on cruise control, you turn off cruise control, you turn on other features, you turn them off. You want to be able to live in a higher level interaction with the machine, but still have the machine always doing what you want it to do and nothing more.
Well, David Mindell is a professor of aeronautics and astronautics at MIT and the former director of MIT's program in science, technology, and society. His book is Our Robots, Ourselves, Robotics and the Myths of Autonomy. Real pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for inviting me.
And listeners, stay with us. Coming up, pianist Fred Hirsch celebrates a return to Boston and a milestone in his life. Stick with us. I'm Anthony Brooks.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.